Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to the Psyche Whisperer Radio Show. I'm your host, AJ Mahari. Psyche Whisperer Radio Show examines a wide variety of topics, interviewing eclectic guests, all to bring to you and provide for you thought-provoking contemplation to awaken your awareness even more fully. Everything that unfolds in our life experience speaks to both our individual and our collective psyche, breath, soul, mind, life. Be sure to visit our website at psychewhisperer.com. Follow us on Facebook and or subscribe to this radio show on iTunes. Thanks for joining us today, and I hope you'll find today's show interesting. And on today's show, entitled Psychiatry and Biology, Is It Science?, I'm going to be interviewing Dr. Niall McLaren. And for those listeners who are not professionals, like I'm not a professional either, and some of this might be technical or a little hard to understand at times, please bear with my intro, which is a little bit longer than most, as I try to just give you some background on where Dr. McLaren is coming from, and then hopefully Dr. McLaren will be able to explain it to us all in ways that are more understandable so people can think more about what he proposes and the questions he puts to his own profession, the profession of psychiatry. And Dr. Niall McLaren is an Australian psychiatrist. His work opposes the mainstream view in psychiatry to the extent that he argues modern psychiatry has no scientific basis whatsoever. However, he insists that he is not anti-psychiatry, but a committed scientist following his duty of criticizing the prevailing models in his field in order to improve it. He is the author of two books, Humanizing Madness, Psychiatry and the Cognitive Neurosciences, published in 2007, and Humanizing Psychiatry, the Bio-Cognitive Model, published in 2009. And I just wanted to share with listeners that I've read both of these books now, and, you know, there's some technical aspects to some of the things that Dr. McLaren is talking about in his books, but that I found his books to be very understandable. And he's, I think, gone to great lengths, no doubt, to put a lot of very, what might otherwise be complicated information into about as plain English as you could put it into. So for people out there who might be thinking, oh, you know, I might not understand this, or it seems like it's way too involved or technical, or like maybe it's only for professionals, I really encourage you to check out Dr. McLaren's books, Humanizing Madness and Humanizing Psychiatry, because they really are written in ways that us lay people can maybe not easily always understand, but certainly can understand with a close kind of paced style of reading. Very accessible style of writing that Dr. McLaren has been able to accomplish in these two amazing and informative books. And he's currently working on another book that's due out later this year in 2010. His books are a culmination of a long, and he says, lonely journey. The response of mainstream psychiatry in Australia to his work ranges from indifference to hostility. But McLaren does not claim to be anti-psychiatry. As a psychiatrist with 35 years' diverse experience in difficult and remote areas, he insists his interest lies in building the foundations for a better psychiatry. And according to Dr. McLaren, critical analysis of the logical status of modern psychiatry shows that psychiatry has no rational basis to its practice, its teaching, and its research. At best, it is a proto-science. He regards psychoanalysis and behaviorism as historical aberrations, 80-year deviations which could have been averted if psychiatrists had looked critically at what was being offered. And Dr. McLaren also argues that biological psychiatry is, as he puts it, mere scientism. The inappropriate application of scientific methods and procedures to questions with no empirical content. The claim that mental disorder can be reduced to a matter of brain disorder is, in Dr. McLaren's insistence, a metaphysical claim, that which cannot be resolved by brain scans or blood tests. He goes on to say the claim that all mental disorder is due to chemical imbalance of the brain is an ideological claim where ideology preconceives reality. He emphasizes that the major problem with modern psychiatry is that it lacks a unified model of the mind and has become entrapped in a biological reductionist paradigm. The reasons for this biological shift are intuitive, as reductionism has been very effective in other fields of science and medicine. However, despite reductionism's efficacy in explaining the smallest parts of the brain, this does not explain the mind, which is where he contends the majority of psychopathology stems from. An example would be that every aspect of a computer can be understood scientifically down to the very last atom. However, this does not reveal the program that drives this hardware. Dr. McLaren's message is definitely one that puts forward the idea that psychiatry is in crisis. And in McLaren's book, Humanizing Madness, he demonstrates that psychoanalysis, behaviorism, and biological psychiatry are not scientific in nature and cannot be developed to the point where their failings can be overcome. He argues that they are totally flawed and an obstruction to the development of a formal scientific model of mental disorder. He regards this latter point as important because he believes that mental disorder is a reality and sufferers are denied rational treatment just because academic psychiatry has failed to provide practitioners with a consistent treatment program. He extends this criticism to cover the idea of an eclectic psychiatry and the biopsychosocial model of the late New York psychiatrist George Engel. He further shows that the dualist model of Karl Popper and John Eccles is essentially irrational, and hence all substance dualistic models must fail. And Dr. McLaren describes in his work his theory of mind, which hopefully he'll speak to us more about in this interview. So you have to ask yourself, you know, what do you believe and what do you think, and how are you supposed to know, especially if you're someone who is in need of help from the mental health profession and psychiatry in particular. What's going on? What's up with psychiatry? What's right with it maybe? Or what's wrong with psychiatry? Keep an open mind, and now we're going to talk to Dr. McLaren and find out how he backs up his claims and his arguments in what is, I think, still to this day, not necessarily just one man's quest, but a rather less than popular quest on the part of someone who, I think anyway, has a lot of valid things to say. And it's always tough for anyone, especially someone to come, you know, in their own profession, in a profession like psychiatry, to come out and challenge the status quo. And I think when someone does that, it bears paying attention to. Well, g'day, people. Here I am. Dr. McLaren has not yet made his way to joining me. He's going to be hopefully Skyping in from his home in Western Australia. I don't know if he's having any technical difficulty or what, because we have quite the time difference, which has been quite the challenge in setting up this interview. And, of course, this is an interview. This is a show that really is dependent upon Dr. McLaren's expertise, because like it's not like I can just fill time right now in place of Dr. McLaren, or that I have all to say what he has to say. I have read the books, but that doesn't make me an expert by any means. Oh, hang on. Maybe Dr. McLaren's with us now. Just a second.
Oh, Dr. McLaren.
Good morning. I'm terribly sorry. We've had a problem at this end of the line.
However, oh, that's fine. I'm just so relieved you're here. My first question for you, and you like to be called Jock, is that right?
That's correct, yes.
Okay, I just would like to clarify that for listeners because I'm, you know, would call you Dr. McLaren otherwise out of respect, but you want to be called Jock, so Jock it is. So my first question for you today, Jock, is can you briefly explain what a psychiatrist is, what you do in your daily work, and so what the purpose of being a psychiatrist really is all about?
Yes, the psychiatrist is a medical specialist, so we do an ordinary medical degree, and then we'll practice for a while in mostly in general practice, but in other areas. In fact, I practiced in neurosurgery because I wanted to be a neurosurgeon, but I swapped over to psychiatry. Then you've got another period of training. So in this country, that's 5 years. I think in US and Canada, it's probably about 4 years postgraduate training, and then you're fully qualified as a psychiatrist. So psychiatry approaches mental disorder from the point of view of nowadays of it being a biochemical disorder of the brain. And that is the theory that I challenge in my work. Psychiatry differs from psychology. Psychology is a university course. People will enroll in a Bachelor of Arts or a Bachelor of Science and specialize in psychology, which is very much research-oriented. And their interest in treatment comes after their basic science. So theirs is more basic science than ours. Ours is much more practical.
Okay, and you've published 2 books, which I have talked a little bit about and mentioned here just when I was filling time, but Humanizing Psychiatry and Humanizing Madness. And in both your books, you apply the philosophy of science to psychiatry. I was wondering if you could explain what the philosophy of science is and how you've applied it to psychiatry.
That's quite a complex question. Philosophy of science is really the principles and procedures that make a science. That is to say, how you can distinguish one particular field from another and say that this one's science, whereas that one's not. And so you've got a series of principles, procedures, policies, mechanisms, and the debate in philosophy of science is what are these principles that constitute, separate science from non-science? How can we improve them? How can we generalize them so that we have better science? Now, applying that to psychiatry is a bit difficult. If you ask ordinary conventional psychiatrists these days, they would just look at you blankly and say, well, psychiatry is a branch of medicine and medicine is biological, therefore psychiatry is biological. But that question actually has to be examined very carefully. It's not the sort of question that you can assume to be true without consideration, because in psychiatry we're dealing with a totally different subject matter from ordinary general medicine. In medicine you're dealing with the biological body and the processes of biology, but in psychiatry we're dealing with the mental realm and the processes of mind. Now, do the principles of biological science apply to the mental realm? That's the crucial question. My work says that they do not. Although I must admit that, freely admit, in fact, that I'm in a very, very small minority at the moment, because the vast majority of psychiatrists throughout the world are absolutely convinced that the principles of biological medicine apply holus-volus to the mental realm, and they will give a full explanation of all mental life. I think that is completely wrong.
And do you think that they do that just because of the way that they were trained and maybe because they haven't looked beyond the medical model? Like someone like yourself, like you've looked into philosophy, so you've applied something different. Could that be like the difference?
That's correct. In psychiatry, there is no debate about the nature of mental disorder. Wherever you go especially in the English-speaking world, but pretty well throughout the world today, you will be told mental disorder is a biochemical disturbance of the brain. It's a chemical imbalance in the brain, and that's all there is to that. Now, the question is, can a physical disturbance of the brain cause specific mental disturbances? And this is where philosophy comes into its own, because the philosophy of mind is one of the most ancient fields of human interest and human study. and it's a very, very difficult area to study. Now, psychiatrists simply assume that the mind can be reduced to the brain. That is a specific maneuver to answer the problems of mind, that you simply drop the concept of mind down onto the brain and it will fit perfectly. So, for example, if you have the concept of a car or an automobile, you can drop that down onto its engine and its transmission and its wheels, and those subparts will explain the function of a car perfectly with no bits left over. Actually, that's not quite true, but that's good enough. And so that's the notion that applies in psychiatry, that by simply dropping mind, the bits of mind, down onto the brain and assigning a specific mental function to a specific part of the brain, you will explain everything about the brain, the mind, with nothing left over, and that includes mental disorder. I think that is completely wrong. There is absolutely no reason whatsoever to believe that pure mental concepts like meaning, for example, or value, or worth, or beauty, or anything like that, can be reduced to brain functions. They are wholly meant and irreducibly mental functions. So in this respect, psychiatry only seems to be scientific. They are following in the footsteps of general medicine, but they haven't thought it out properly.
And so, you know, just for us lay people then, are the mind and the brain one then, or are they separate? Or do they have separate like parts?
That is the crucial question. You've put your finger right on the crucial question. Psychiatry assumes they are one and the same thing, whereas, in fact, every other person in the world who works in this area, all the cognitive scientists and philosophers and people like that, have left that behind 50 years ago. Psychiatry really is stuck in the science of the 1950s.
And that's because they continue to ascribe to this medical idea about the brain.
That's correct. It's brought up in the medical tradition. You must understand that to pass in medicine, you don't actually have to be terribly bright. You have to have an extremely good memory, and you have to be very well organized. And you've got to be polite too. And if you've got those three things, you will eventually pretty well always pass in medicine. You are not taught to think critically. You are taught to accept what the professors say without argument, and then you are likely to get ahead. The whole ethos in medicine is training people to be ultra, ultra safe. And so they don't want anybody varying from the mainstream procedures and principles which have been established carefully. So the whole idea of critical thinking in medicine is anathema. As a medical student, if you start criticizing your professors, you will get into quite serious trouble.
Well, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And so it's kind of sounds like a really rigid sort of structure, like being in med school and professors and such. And so I'm just wondering, at least in my mind anyway, why is this exploding onto the scene now, sort of like all this news and talk about, you know, brain studies and like neurobiology, neurochemistry, and all these rapid advances in drugs for mental illness? Because I don't recall hearing this for like ever. You know, it just seems like more recent, like, I don't know, 5, 8 years, maybe a bit longer. So you're saying that your profession isn't a science, and so what does it mean psychiatry is, and what's up with all this, physiological, neuro stuff that's got to do with, you know, hey, let's treat it with drugs?
We're now moving into what would be called the sociology of psychiatry. How come one particular group of people can take control of a profession and hammer their views down the throats of the rest of the medical profession and of the funding agencies and the general public? And the answer is that these people firmly believe their view that mental disorder is brain disorder. They are absolutely convinced of this. They resent quite bitterly anybody who questions them, and they've got control of the money, quite frankly, because the research institutes and the granting bodies only pay for certain sorts of research these days. And the people who are sitting on the grant committees are, in fact, all absolutely convinced of this, approach to psychiatry. So it's become a self-perpetuating industry. The other thing to remember too is that the drug companies make huge amounts of money out of this. I think in the US last year there were $11.7 billion worth of antidepressants sold, and they finance a very large part of the research. You will be aware, of course, that there have been some quite disgraceful incidents over the last few years where senior psychiatric researchers were essentially producing the results the drug companies paid them to produce. And so I would say that the whole profession has been suborned by money, by the thought that they're onto something big. And there's also another factor to consider, which is really the psychology or the psychological state of psychiatrists, because we had, for many, many years, we were treated as second or third rate doctors, and real doctors, as we still call them, would laugh at us and make fun of it and jokes about us behind, not always behind our backs, quite often into your face. And so at last we seem to be getting back into the mainstream, and I think this is one of the reasons why you hear so much about biological psychiatry. But the press, the media, are firmly in the hands of the psychiatric industry. There's no question about that.
And do you see any connection between what's called big pharma and sort of like the money flow and the connection with the media?
There is. There's no question about that. Just this week, I had two expensive glossy magazines come into my mailbox. One's new, it's just being published in this country, and another one is well known, it's called Psychiatric News. And these very expensive productions, they're put out every month by the drug companies. They're free to the psychiatric profession and to various other centres, and they push the biological line unremittingly. You cannot get any material published in these magazines which is not 110% in favour of the biological psychiatry line. They would not publish any of my material. In fact, ordinary journals won't either. And we can come back onto that later if you like.
Yeah, so definitely, because I know that it's just about, it includes also in book publishing as well. But I was just wondering about this sort of, the pharmacology. The fact that pharma, like pharmaceutical companies, are funding these studies, I mean, there's no coincidence there in the outcome of these studies, is there?
We would like to think there's not, and for many years people believed there was no coincidence, but now it is absolutely clear, following the business with Joseph Biedermann and Nemiroff and all the other people in the US, that the drug companies were essentially writing the results that they wanted, and these people were simply apparently putting their names on them. This was subject of congressional inquiry in the US, and there's a lot of material on it in the news and on the internet now. But it seems to me beyond any doubt that these people had allowed themselves to be sucked in by the drug companies. I don't think it was any great effort on behalf of the drug companies, and there were huge amounts of money changing hands.
And so how is a consumer supposed to, first of all, a lot of people might not be aware of some of this, but how is a consumer supposed to look at that? Because doesn't it just look rather unethical?
It is not just rather unethical, it's totally unethical. And in my view, the people who are guilty of that should no longer be permitted to stay in the profession. But in fact, they are. They're very, very influential. And Nemiroff, for example, was forced out of Emory University, and then he popped up in a prestigious university in Florida. It was quite simple. He just applied for a job, and his friend gave it to him. And now it looks as though one of the chairmen of the National Institutes of Mental Health in Bethesda in Maryland has been implicated too. So the whole thing just seems to be getting worse and worse. And it all comes from the idea that people want to prove that mental disorder is a form of brain disorder, because they believe that the amounts of money that are involved in this would be beyond imagination.
Well, I know that I found something interesting because, like I just had trouble believing all that I was hearing about, this being brain disorder stuff. And so I kind of just never really believed it. But, I'm sure just like yourself, only just like in a way smaller version, I know how unpopular that is. But so I kind of went searching on the Internet because, I'm somebody who's blogging about this stuff, but I'm not a professional. So I needed to go are there professionals out there who feel this way? So does my thinking have any credibility? And one of the things I found right before I found one of your YouTube videos was a video by a psychologist whose name's going to escape me right now. But in his video, he talked about, I guess it's the National Association of Mental Health or something. I don't know, NAMI in the United States.
NAMI, National Association of Mental Illness.
Illness, yeah, right, okay. And he said, and this was, you know, he talked about a congressman having to force them to declare their funding sources because they wouldn't just do that voluntarily. Mm-hmm. Turned out that they were 56% funded by pharmaceutical companies.
Yes,
and I think that's interesting when you think about the work that they're doing, that they're to be serving the mental health consumers, if you will, or people with mental illness or disorder, and yet they also were the first place anyway that I saw online associated with calling mental illness a brain disorder. So, I mean, do you have anything to say to that? Because I just find it so, I don't know, well, unethical, troubling, and
In a word, it's quite frightening. Nobody knows the full extent of the penetration of the various community mental health organizations by financial interests. Nobody has any idea. I've always known that NAMI, that's National Institute of Mental Illness in the U.S., is completely in the pocket of the big drug companies, but I didn't know it was to that extent. 56% is frightening.
Is the quote in this YouTube video from a psychologist who also, he has an extensive website, I just really apologize for getting his name, but he also was he was reading off a piece of paper, and it comes from a congressman, I'm not sure if his last name is Grassley, but in the United States, who forced that issue, and that was the percentage that was come up with.
Yes, that I'm sure that figure is correct. If not, it's too low. But when people get on the internet, you know, say they, for example, some parents are told your boy has got ADHD, the first thing they do is get on the internet and start searching ADHD. And it will pop up a lot of very professional-looking websites. Most of these are financed by the drug companies, even if they are nominally under the control of community organization. So, for example, somebody in British Columbia might decide that they'd rather deal with the British Columbia Association for ADHD, and they'll get in touch with them. But those organizations are getting money from drug companies, assistance, et cetera, et cetera, to set up their websites and man their telephones, all that sort of thing. So there's the money. We do not know where the money is. What I can tell you, though, is that there is no money coming towards the philosophy of science. There is no money coming towards examining the idea that mental disorder is in fact a psychological phenomenon.
And so in other words, really in a lot of ways, there really just isn't the money coming that should be toward the actual treatment and real care of a lot of human beings who are suffering.
There's a lot of money around, but I think it's being spent very badly. I don't know a lot about the Canadian system. I've seen the American system in action, and of course I know the Australian system quite well. Your costs are similar to ours, and we have a universal national medical health service here, and psychiatry is a very small part of it, but there is a whole lot of money being spent on other areas that are associated with mental health. But they all follow this notion that mental disorder is a brain disorder. This is now simply accepted by the funding bodies as the truth, in inverted commas. There's no question of that, and you cannot get anybody to question it. For example, in Australia, the main research funding body is the National Health and Medical Research Council. They do not accept applications for grants for non-biological research in psychiatry.
Wow. And is this like, you know, would it be too simple to say that, you know, psychiatry has just been hijacked here?
No, I don't, that's too simple at all. I don't think psychiatry ever knew where it was going. In the days of the psychoanalytic era, it is quite clear that psychiatry didn't have a scientific model of mental disorder. And on the other side of the road, walking sort of in parallel to them but not talking, were, of course, the behaviorists. the Skinnerians and the Pavlovians, and those two groups of people didn't actually talk to each other at all, and both of them were in fact wrong. So biological psychiatry picked up where those two fizzled out. In the 1970s, psychoanalysis fell into a hole. It became clear that it was not a science. And in the 1980s, the same thing happened to behaviorism. The behaviorism is now restricted, very, very restricted compared with what it was, say, 50 years ago. And the biological psychiatrists were left psychiatrists were left sitting on a rock. They were suddenly found that they didn't have a theory of mental disorder, so they have jumped on the biological theory and grasped that like drowning people grabbing a lifebelt, because there's nothing else. They see nothing else. Their understanding of mental psychological approaches is based in psychoanalysis, and they know that that's completely wrong. But they're not prepared to allow anybody else to have a say. And there's an intense antagonism in the psychiatric publishing industry to anybody who criticizes the prevailing model. And I think the money's got a lot to do with it.
Well, yeah, it looked like that just to me, too. And you know, I'm just like, you know, someone who was a mental health consumer in the past and not a professional, but I kind of saw it as being obvious. And yet, you know, I just know a lot of people who think I'm crazy for thinking that myself. But in one of your the chapters of your latest book, Humanizing Psychiatry, of course, you know, you're critical of this mainstream, you know, idea where they're going with everything. So you're also critical of the psychiatric publishing industry, and you essentially said that, you know, it isn't scientific at all, the industry, and how can you justify this? And then also, you know, what is the place, what is the critical nature of, you know, criticism to any science?
This is a terribly important question. The nature, the role of criticism in scientific work is that criticism is the engine of scientific progress. The whole purpose of a scientific education is to train you to criticize the models that were in existence at the time you entered the profession. And it is by this means, by people actively and consistently criticizing the prevailing model, that we force it to get better. If there's no criticism, it doesn't go anywhere, and you end up with a political agenda or a religious agenda or something like that. And in particular, if people are prevented from criticizing, then you end up with an ideology. And that's what's happened to psychiatry. There is no rational, logical basis to suppose that all mental disorder is a biochemical disturbance of the brain. The profession itself has grasped this notion, and they are now actively suppressing any criticism of that that ideological stance, that ideological view. And I've documented this carefully, and I have a new book coming out shortly. Now I'll be going over to the US in October to launch that. And one of the chapters is entitled, I'll read it out. Chapter 7 says, A Life of Its Own, The Strange Case of the Biopsychosocial Model. Now, I only use this as an exemplar of the, essentially, of the deceitful nature of the psychiatric publishing industry. If you go to the website of the Canadian Journal of Psychiatry, for example, which is a very reputable journal, and Canadians are highly regarded people. In fact, Canadians are about the only people that Australians respect. There's something good about being on the opposite sides of the Pacific for you.
Yeah.
From us. Now, the website of the Canadian Psychiatric Association says that, and I'm reading this chapter, the association's first objective is to uphold and develop the biopsychosocial approach to the practice of psychiatry. The Canadian Journal of Psychiatry includes peer-reviewed scientific articles on blah, 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 and a broad range of biopsychosocial topics. Now, you might be saying, now, what's this thing called a biopsychosocial approach? And you would put that in Google and you search it, and up would come a thing called the biopsychosocial model. And this has apparently been around for years, and it is the prevailing model for moderate psychiatrists throughout the world. There is a slight problem with this, which I've pointed out to the Canadian Journal of Psychiatry, in that in 1998 I showed that the biopsychosocial model doesn't exist. Now, you'd think that in the 12 years since then, the editors of the Canadian Journal of Psychiatry could catch up, and take this term out, but not at all. They haven't. Not only do they have they not caught up, but they actively resist any attempts to tell them that they're promulgating or proposing a non-existent model. I wrote a letter to the journal, a very polite letter to the editor of the journal, Dr. Joel Paris, and said that I wish to bring to your attention the fact that the biopsychosocial model doesn't exist. And Dr. Paris sent a letter back saying that's very interesting, but in fact, we only publish letters which address papers published in our journal, so I can't publish your letter. And I thought that's a bit strange. So I then wrote a much more detailed paper on it and showed that that what they were doing was completely wrong. And in due course, I got another polite letter back from Dr. Paris, which said the same thing. I find your points you make are very interesting, but unfortunately we can't publish your paper because it lies outside our brief. Now, what the hell does that mean? What does it mean when an allegedly scientific journal says that pointing out that they don't have a model of science is outside their brief? I think this is completely crazy, completely off the planet. But that's what's going on. And, you know, I have no doubt that Dr. Paris is a very respectable and, very respectable gentleman. He's got the four C's. He's caring, considerate, cultured, and compassionate. I'm sure he's all of those things. But he just is not looking at what he's doing. He's supposed to criticize his model of psychiatry, and he's not doing it. So that's Canadian psychiatry.
What do you think outside their brief actually meant? Just sort of like maybe could that be outside their agenda?
That's exactly what it is. It's a polite way of saying nick off. It's a polite way of saying nick off, buster. We decide what gets in our journal, not you.
Right, yeah. So it's kind of an exclusive sounding club. Not only the
very,
journal,
very
the whole sort of, group that, you know, like, quote, mainstream psychiatry now, unquote.
Yes, it is a very, very exclusive club. And what's happened is that a small group of people with this ideological commitment to biological psychiatry have taken control of the profession and are actively making sure that nobody else gets in. Now, what's happened here with the journal, the Australian and New Zealand Journal of Psychiatry, is similar, only worse. For the last 6 years, they have been publishing material which is either statistical, just straight statistics, you know, how many people, the one that they seem to like is how much people with schizophrenia smoke. I haven't got a clue what that's got to do with it, but they publish a lot of stuff on that. And the other thing they will publish is hardcore biology or neurobiology, which allegedly is there to prove that biological psychiatry is correct, but in fact it never addresses the topic. Now, if you try and criticize those papers, you will not get anything published. So, and they have also been pushing this biopsychosocial model. Now, earlier this year, the editor of the Australian New Zealand Journal of Psychiatry published an editorial under his own name in which he said, quote, a biopsychosocial approach is widely espoused in psychiatry, unquote. And he didn't give any references. So I immediately sent a letter to him saying, I dispute this. I do not believe that this is true. It was a very politely worded letter, but that's exactly what it said. Mm-hmm. And he just wrote, he sent it back, and in 2 hours he rejected that letter, which means that he is actually personally reviewing all my stuff. In 2 hours he rejected the letter saying that it was not suitable for publication. So I sent another letter back to him saying, you don't have the right to reject material on the basis that you believe it's not suitable. This is a scientific journal, you must publish criticism. And he just didn't answer that. So then, a little while later, they had another paper published by a person called Robert Cloninger from Washington School of Medicine in Missouri, I think it is, in St. Louis in Missouri. And that is very, very hardcore. That's where the DSM-3, DSM-4 actually came from. And they had solicited this paper from Cloninger, and it was absolutely ridiculous. It was the worst sort of pseudoscience trying to justify psychiatry in terms of evolutionary theory. It was absolute rubbish. And if we gave that to a first-year philosophy class, they would just laugh at it. So I sent a letter, this was a strongly worded letter saying this is absolutely disgraceful. If I'd submitted that paper, you would have rejected it in 2 hours. And I think that the editorial board either has to justify what they've done or resign. That came a letter from the editor in 2 hours, of course. No, wait, and this was a little bit longer. It came back saying, your letter will never be published while I'm editor of this journal. If you want me dismissed, you can contact the president of the college. I have absolute confidence that presidents of colleges will never, ever act definitively, so I didn't do anything. In March this year, the new journal came out, New Australian Journal came out, and there was a paper published by the editor of the journal and Robert Cloninger together. And this is the result of a collaboration going back over quite a number of years. So what that says is that the editor of the journal solicited his friend to write a paper. He accepted it within a few hours, according to the website, and he published it. Then he suppressed criticism of that paper, and he suppressed, and he said he would never publish anything. So I put all this in a letter and in a chapter. That's what this chapter's about. And just out of courtesy, I sent it to the college and said, could you please look at this and check the facts? I want to make sure that every fact in this paper is correct. And 6 days later, the editor resigned. So that was 2 weeks ago. So
wow.
He's fallen on his sword, which is about the only thing he could have done, but I don't think he went gracefully. And that's not unusual. I think this is across the board.
Yeah, well, and this is something that, you know, I don't think most people who are, you know, diagnosed with mental disorders, mental illness, or who are loved ones of those diagnosed, like, they wouldn't know all this is going on, and you know, I wonder, what are they supposed to think knowing all this is going on?
Well, they don't know what's going on because the psychiatric publishing industry is actively breaching scientific ethics by refusing to criticize the prevailing model of mental disorder. The prevailing model of mental disorder is the biological model, that mental disorder just is brain disorder or a chemical disturbance of the brain. It is the duty of the psychiatric editors to publish criticism of that claim, and they do not. They actively publish material, they solicit material which supports that point of view, and they actively suppress material which criticizes that point of view, and that is the very grossest breach of publishing ethics imaginable. That is the sort of thing that an ideological political party or religion or fanatical group would do, but these people are supposed to be upholding the ethics of science, and they are not. They are betraying the ethics of science. And the ordinary person in the street has no chance of knowing this. You cannot find this out. It takes me so much work to get anything out of these people. They simply will not answer questions. They do not believe they're accountable, and they actively suppress criticism, and they actively, selectively publish material which supports their point of view, and that, in my view, is disgraceful.
Well, right, and their point of view with this, you know, whole brain disorder stuff is all about, hey, giving the public, you know, pills and drugs like it's candy almost, like, here, have some mind candy.
It is probably worse than that, because this is lime candy that has very, very serious effects on your brain.
Absolutely.
While I was in the US, last year, I went to a conference in, and one of the people presenting presenting a paper gave a list of children, the drugs that children were on, and what they found was that in his catchment area, and you know what that term means, that there were something like 63 children on more than 4 drugs a day. Now, these are children. These are under 12, and they're from 3 till 12. And of those 60 children, I think about 60, 57 were actually in care. They had become wards of the state under judicial orders. And these children were getting up to 8 major psychiatric drugs per day in doses usually given to adults. Now, that, in my mind, that made me feel sick. It really made me feel sick. But there's no question that this is going on.
Well, and that sounds just atrocious. I mean, but I don't know that you could say it's more atrocious than even the medicating of society at large.
It's part of the medicating of society at large. It's part of an undeclared program to get people to take psychiatric drugs regularly in large doses in the very long term. Now, you're probably aware that now that there's a principle sort of being touted around that if a person's had two episodes of depression, they have got chronic depression, and in fact they should be on antidepressants for life. And that's just what's being, so if by the time you've got to 25, you've had two episodes of depression, say at 18 you wanted to join the army and you were rejected because you had flat feet, so you had a bit, you got a bit depressed. And then at 24, you had a girlfriend, she ran off with your best mate, which, you know, I don't know if it happens in Canada, but it sure happens here.
Oh yeah, it happens.
So, you know, this, yes, it's human. But so this 24-year-old kid, who maybe he isn't terribly bright and he's not terribly well educated, he just takes and grabs a handful of the nearest tablets and washes them down with alcohol. And so then people are now saying he's been depressed twice. He should be on antidepressants for life. But these drugs have got major side effects. They're very dulling. They cause weight gain. They cause cardiac effects. They affect people's sex lives. They have long-term major effects on all aspects of life, and plus they have serious social effects. So that, for example, if this kid's taking antidepressants long-term, then he can't get he can't work in a lot of parts of the mining industry. He cannot join the military. He can't work as a policeman. He can't have a heavy truck driver's license, an interstate truck driver's license. He can't have a taxi driver's license. He can't be a nurse. A whole lot of things like that. So we're not mucking around. This is serious stuff.
Oh, absolutely. And I know that I don't know where I was looking the other day, because sometimes I get in a web search and then I get go sideways. But I was reading where there's like two or three, I think, in the United States right now, drug companies busy trying to quickly settle some lawsuits. And I know one involves the drugs like Prexia, and I can't remember the other two. But, you know, again, because of the side effects, I think it actually was a lot about, with regard to that and another drug, the cause of diabetes, along with weight gain and diabetes and things of that nature. And, you know, we don't hear a lot of news about that half of it.
No. The manufacturers of Zyprexa, which is olanzapine, and I think it's Pfizer, but I could be wrong on that. To my knowledge, those people settled a $2 billion case last year or late the year before. I don't keep track of a lot of this sort of stuff because that's not quite my field, not my interest. But there have been some very, very large settlements, you know, $1 billion settlements, $2 billion settlements for inappropriate use of these drugs and advocating that people use them wrongly and off-label, et cetera, et cetera. And
well,
in Australia, drugs are very much...
Isn't it true, too, that there's also some accusation out there that these drugs are being, you know, pushed on the public with maybe some knowledge about some of these effects that aren't as documented as they should be?
Oh, absolutely. Just as they knew the problems with Vioxx, which was an anti-inflammatory, some years ago, that drug was known to cause cardiac trouble, and yet it was still put on the market. There's no question about that. Olanzapine has always been known to cause massive weight gain. I saw a young woman the other day. She's about 23 years old, and she is extremely fat. And she'd been put on olanzapine 15 milligrams a night 12 months before by a mental health service somewhere. And she'd gained 42 kilos in 12 months. That's about 100 pounds.
Oh,
in,
my God, wow.
That measure. So, you know, this previously healthy young mother was just sitting around the place doped out of her eyeballs, eating all day and gaining weight, and she was going to develop diabetes and hypertension. There's no question about that. She was going to develop arthritis. So these are serious long-term complications of these drugs. And yet these drugs are being pushed on the general public as more or less mild, nice, helpful things that sensible people would give to themselves and to their families. Nothing could be further from the truth. They are major, serious, intrusive chemical agents with a multitude of largely unknown side effects, which we ought to treat with the greatest of care.
Well, I guess one other question just before, because I want to get to a few other things here too, but one other question just following along with this is, not only like all the harmful nature of all these drugs and everything and what's going on, but I mean, what's happened to like actual psychiatric treatment? Or what maybe
psychiatric
treatment?
Well, psychiatric treatment these days is largely dominated by the cost of the treatment. So the old-fashioned approach where you could have a leisurely psychoanalysis and somebody else would pay for it, that's gone. And I agree, because psychoanalysis was grossly inefficient and it just diverted resources from the poor to the wealthy. And I think that's very bad.
Mm-hmm.
So psychiatric treatment these days is dominated by the idea that biological psychiatry is cheap. Biological psychiatry, they say, is cheaper than psychoanalysis, therefore put everybody on drugs and that's all there is to it. And so increasingly psychiatric services are dominated by the costs. And in the US in particular, the health maintenance organizations, the private insurers, will tell will allocate you how much psychiatric treatment you can have in 1 year, in 5 years, and in your lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, is nowhere near enough. But when you add it up over the years, it actually ends up costing 3, 4, 5, 10 times as much as precisely targeted psychological management early in the process. So in the US, when they take a psychiatric history, they only do it for about 15 or 20 minutes. Now, I was floored when I saw this. It takes me an hour to get the basic history from any person. My history takes 1 hour, and quite often that doesn't get me the information, enough information, and we'll continue the process at the next appointment.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't cut corners that way. It's a bit like saying, we'll put cheap petrol in my car, cheap gasoline in my auto, because that'll save money. It does for the first year, but after that you're going to have a new engine. And
giving this woman,
the one I saw the other day, olanzapine for 12 months, had caused probably $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 worth of complications. That's not sensible medicine.
But well, so they just don't worry about that part, though, do they?
It's not that nobody worries about it. It's that everybody's attention is diverted to the holy grail of finding the precise biochemical marker that says this is the cause of mental disorder, and they're all looking at that. Nobody's looking at the grubby grotty tail of psychiatry, the fat sluggish patients who can't get jobs, who are taking overdoses because nobody's listening to them, who've been shoved off and handed out, farmed out to you know, counsellors, community counsellors and drug counsellors and people like that, who in the main have only got a 3-month certificate in drug counselling and things like that. So psychiatrists, the profession of psychiatry is hypnotised by the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow called the biological cure for mental disorder. And what they're doing is ignoring all the patients who are being crushed in the rush.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, and that, you know, hey, unethical, one doesn't have to think too hard, you know, this is so wrong.
Well, I believe it is wrong, and I believe it is so wrong that I'm prepared to risk serious libel actions from the Australian New Zealand College of Psychiatrists, or it's actually Royal Australian New Zealand College of Psychiatrists, and the journal. Now, these are very, very wealthy people. But I am totally isolated within the College of Psychiatrists. I have not spoken to an Australian psychiatrist for nearly 30 months. I don't expect that to change, particularly after what's happened to their golden-haired boy, the editor. I imagine they're sitting down there now sticking pins into a little voodoo doll with my name on it.
Yeah.
That's too bad. This is what's got to be done, and the whole point about freedom is freedom doesn't give you the chance to do what you want to do. It gives you the chance to do what you believe you ought to do. And I believe it is a matter of necessity that we oppose this hegemonistic ideological push in psychiatry to declare mental disorder a form of brain disorder and put everybody on drugs. Now, I think people would be happy if they put drugs in the water supply. Then they'd be happy. I think that's morally wrong.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, just one question I had for you, too, also, is how, given all the resistance that you have and, you know, this courageous, almost, it seems like one-man fight you have going on here. You know, an ethical stand in an otherwise not so ethical, it seems, field at the moment. How did you manage to get your books published? Like, was that difficult?
That was impossible. I tried for years to get the stuff published, and eventually I gave up and put it on the internet. I said, well, I'll just give it away. And it was found after quite a number of years. It was found by a little boutique publisher in Ann Arbor in Michigan. It's LH Press, Loving Healing Press. Now, they're much more psychologically oriented, and they don't like the biological model. So the owner and publisher, who's Victor Folkman, saw this material that I'd put on the internet, and he contacted me and said he would like to publish it. I was absolutely thrilled to bits. So I've been collaborating with Victor ever since. Victor's a lovely chap. He's not making any money out of this, and I think it keeps him awake at night publishing these different books. He's got quite a number of lonely authors, and that's the only way that it's getting attention now. But so people are starting to pick it up, and I'm learning how to use the internet. My son helps me there. He's 18 years of age, and of course he was brought up in the internet era, so he knows all about it. And I've got different people, you know, around the world saying you should use this and you should try that. This will work. I was just put onto a thing called the Student Doctor Network last week, and so we'll try that and see how that goes. But that's certainly attracting a lot of interest. And the whole point I've realised now is to bypass the mainstream industry, psychiatric industry, and focus on the people coming into it. That is to say, the medical students and the psychiatric trainees. And so that's what I'll be doing when I go across to the US in October this year.
Yeah, because you've done a little of that already, haven't you, and found that some of the students are receptive to your message?
Yes, yes, absolutely. This will be my third trip. I pick a conference and go across and present a paper, and that way the tax department here pays for my trip, or pays part of it. And then I use that to go around and get myself invited to medical schools to present my material. And there is the reception from the, you know, my generation, the 50-year-old psychiatrist, is pretty cold, but the reception from the young people coming into the profession is very, very excited. In fact, I've tried to go to Canada, but I haven't been able to get any invitations. What I've offered is to go to Canada and to debate the editor of the journal, Dr. Paris, anywhere, anytime, on whatever topic he likes, as long as it says that he doesn't have a scientific publishing policy for his journal. And unfortunately, they won't take up that offer for a public debate. But it's there. I'm
quite
happy
about that. It's interesting also when you mentioned Dr. Paris, because I know I've heard of him, and I know he works in an area that I have an interest in, but there just aren't a lot of, we don't hear as much about things in Canada going on as we do in the States, or in certain areas of mental health or mental illness, or the profession of psychiatry. It's sort of like, I don't know what's going on up here. I mean, I just hope people are, well, they're probably giving their patients drugs, I guess, but they aren't, there isn't some loud drum banging up here the same as in the States, I guess. I don't know. That's probably not a good thing, because it's maybe even more, maybe Canadians are even more unaware. I don't know.
I think Canada is a bit crushed by the monstrous machine that lives just south of your border in this respect, Canadian psychiatry. I've just checked Dr. Paris, Joel Paris, MD, on the on Google, and the first thing that came up was a paper he's published, doesn't say when or where, on borderline personality disorder. So I just go down to the second paragraph. It says, what causes borderline personality disorder? And it goes straight into the biological factors in borderline personality disorder consist of an inborn temperamental abnormality, blah, blah, blah. So straight away, psychological factors, he says, we don't know. So he's hedging his bets. He's having a foot in each camp. But because he's not prepared to take a stand, he's just going to fall between the cracks. So that's what,
well,
he, what he's done there.
Well, interesting about him, too, because, that's where I saw his name come up, because I was surprised to find Canadian psychiatrist, you know, talking about borderline personality disorder, because normally it's, you know, psychiatrists in the United States. And but I do know that I found him in other areas online where, you know, he's been very active in working with professionals in the United States. And I just know of one other doctor in Canada who, you know, his name will escape me right now, too. But he wrote a book. The book wasn't bad. It was about borderline personality disorder, surviving borderline personality disorder or something like that. And he's at Simon Fraser, I think, in Vancouver, B.C. But and actually, there were a few things in that book I did take a bit of issue with. But I don't think you can go too many places online now just in regard to, you know, because I work in this area myself, and I, you know, because I recovered from this thing now, if it exists, right? But it's like, there's just nowhere you can go hardly anymore online without now seeing everyone saying it's a brain disorder also. People who have it being told this, people who are in the BPD, what they call advocacy community, and right there, you know, like I'm not in the same, you know, arena you're in by any means, but I'm also very unpopular because I'm like, you know, over here banging this little drum called, this isn't really true, you know. But I think it takes people's hope away, for one thing.
Yes, it does indeed. I'm just reading here. It says Joel Paris is a professor of psychiatry at McGill University in Montreal. All right. Well, today, as soon as we hang up from this, I'm going to send Dr. Paris an email saying that he doesn't have a scientific model of mental disorder to guide his daily practice, his teaching, and his research. And I want to debate him in public that the Canadian Journal of Psychiatry also doesn't have a scientific publishing policy. And I'm just going to challenge him to that, and we will see what emerges from it. As I said, he's probably a lovely chap. I'm sure he is. But he just happens to be.
I think a lot of these people are good people, but that's the other thing that's confusing. It's like, and so how come they're in this, though, then?
Well, yes, this is it. If they're good people, how come they're so totally wrong? Well, the answer is because they are not trained to be self-critical. They are not trained to take the fundamental basis of what they see as their practice and submit it to critical scrutiny. And this is what the philosophy of science is all about. The scientific progress is generated by criticism. If you take away criticism, all you're left with is an ideology. And the notion that mental disorder is a chemical imbalance of the brain is pure ideology. It has no substantive basis in philosophy or in medicine.
And, you know, I do want to get on to what, you know, you talk about and what you do offer, but just before we go there, I just have to ask you this one question based on, you know, about borderline personality disorder, because, you know, I was diagnosed with it and I recovered from it if, in fact, it exists.
Well, that's a good question.
Because in your email back to me, you said some interesting things, and I just wondered if you could speak about kind of, you know, the whole idea of borderline personality disorder and, of course, now, you know, this touting it as a brain disease. But what's up with that? The diagnosis and then, of course, now this we've talked about how they're saying it's caused, but, I mean, what's up with the diagnosis in the first place?
Well, let's start with the word. What does the term borderline mean? I think it was put up by a chap called Masterson in the early 1950s, and he saw a group of people who seemed to be borderline to everything. They weren't one thing, but they were a bit of everything. And sometimes they could have little psychotic episodes, but they weren't schizophrenic. Sometimes they could act pretty badly, but generally speaking, they were pretty ordinary people. They weren't psychopathic or aggressive, unless it was symptomatic. And they could get depressed, but it wasn't a pure depression. It was a very angry type of depression. So he just said, oh, well, there seems to be a personality style, and it's borderline to everything, so we'll just call it that. Now, every bit of research that I've ever seen says that when you the criteria that are used to diagnose borderline personality disorder are not pure. They are picking up features of different personality disorders. And so borderline personality disorder really only becomes a way of saying that a person's got a fairly severe personality disorder and that they don't fit the other narrow categories. So it's a more or less, it's a rubbish bin. You can dump anybody there that you don't like. And I think this is why women tend to get the diagnosis more than men. Psychiatrists are quite happy to label men as psychopaths or sociopaths, but they don't like saying that about women. They just say, and they're not allowed to say, oh, she's just a damned hysteric. So now they say, oh, she's just a borderline BPD. And that's more or less dumps her in the rubbish bin, and nobody takes her seriously after that.
Well, and I think, too, you know, speaking from my own experience, it's probably easy to dump us in the rubbish bin because when we show up, we're not so friendly.
Well, that says people, you know, people don't know how to manage them. And in my practice is, I'm in private practice, and it's what's called a bulk billing practice, so that I just, I don't actually bill the patients, I bill the government, and I get a lower rate of payment for this than if I were charging private fees. But that doesn't matter. This is my last socialist gesture as I disappear down the gurgler. But so I just see people as they come in more or less off the street. They just get a referral from the general practitioner and they come in. And these are people very often who've been through the mill. They've been through the public system, and quite often some of them have seen private psychiatrists at huge expense, and they're very resentful, and they come in and they're quite angry. But I see them in my little office. It's very quiet. They can park just near the door. They walk in. They are seen immediately. They are never kept waiting. Nobody in my practice waits, unfortunately. The sort of thing that happened this morning when I tried to contact you never happens at work.
Well, that's a good thing.
And it's quiet, it's air-conditioned, it's clean, there are up-to-date magazines for them to read, there's other material there they can look at, and they will be seen on time. And their appointments are next, and it doesn't cost them anything, and they will be getting clear statements of this, this is what you do, this is how we practice. If you don't like it, then we can't reach agreement, and I'll arrange for you to see somebody else. That almost never happens.
Mm-hmm.
The vast majority of people are very happy with this, and I do not get the problems with aggression. And what's happened over the years is that the mental health services, who are about 2 kilometres down the road, will refer to me patients, particularly aggressive young men, that they can't handle. They're not floridly psychotic, so they can't put them on large doses of drugs. The patients are voluntary. They refuse heavy doses of medication, but they're aggressive because they know something's wrong and they want it dealt with. And they're not going to put up with being kept waiting 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So I see them and they get better. I don't have the problems with aggression. In 15 years, and my health isn't as good now as it should be because I've got a lot of arthritis, and I really could not defend myself if somebody wanted to attack me. And in 15 years, I have not been attacked or hit or pushed in any way. I've had to ask 3 people in 15 years to leave the premises but these were people who were demanding drugs, and I said, well, I'm not prepared to prescribe them, and you'll have to go elsewhere, and you'll have to leave now. So I've had no problems, and I think it's how you manage the patients.
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, one experience of mine that, you know, stands out in my mind that's, you know, interesting in this debate or this discussion is, you know, I had a psychiatrist back in about 1987 tell me, because I was, you know, freaking out. I was like, am I ever going to get any better, whatever this is that's wrong with me? And I was trying to, you know, find my way in life. And he said, you know, I'd probably just be the same unless I came up with a better pill. And I wasn't even on any drugs because I refused them. So nothing about that made much sense to me. And just, you know, to put it in a nutshell, if I had believed that guy, I think I'd still be back where I was, because I just, you know, right there I got so angry, I just got on my bike, rode home, swore all the way home, and, you know, I was lucky then. I then turned away from, you know, like how did I get well, whatever you want to call whatever I had, but I guess BPD-like stuff. I turned to psychology. I turned to psychologists and social workers.
Mm-hmm.
Because psychiatry, even back in the 80s, was, you know, that's right when they were starting to get on that ride of, you know, here, try this pill, try that pill. And I just refused. So, and then, of course, I was just a non-compliant whatever, you know, so.
That's right. Yeah
so I think,
well,
I guess we're, go ahead.
Well, what the mental health services don't want is an articulate, non-compliant patient who actually reads what's going on and keeps coming up with questions. Because they can't answer them. So everything is designed to reduce mental disorder to chemical imbalance of the brain. And this is what patients are told. And they're just told this over and over again. And eventually they believe it. And so it goes back to that old joke. You know, the joke about the policeman who was walking along the street at night and he saw a drunk crawling around on the ground under the streetlight. And he said to the drunk, "What are you doing?" And the man said, "I've lost my door key." And the policeman said, "Well, where is it? It's not here." And the man said, "I lost it in the dark." And the policeman said, "Well, shouldn't you look in the dark?" And the drunk said, "No, this is where the light is." And psychiatry is like that. They are looking in the biology because that is where they believe they've got the only chance of finding it, because psychology or mental disorder as psychology is darkness. They can't understand it, but they don't realize that the world's moved, that there are now models of mental disorder which which lighten the darkness. And so we've got to start to make that change. But this is where the industry is now firmly in the grip of people who have invested their whole professions in proving that mental disorder is biological disorder. They, you know, these are people in their who are approaching 60. They've got their degrees. They've got their chairs, their professorships. They've got their travelling grants. They've got all of this sort of stuff. They've got the prestige, and it's all wrong. And they can't give it up. It's like Carl Sagan said.
I just want to say, with all that you just described, they have also power.
They've got power, but they're now prisoners of their own ideology. They're now prisoners of their own propaganda. It would take a very, very brave person to turn around and say, sorry, chaps, we goofed. The whole thing's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I can't see that that's going to happen voluntarily. It has to happen forcefully, and part of the force is giving ordinary people the tools to attack this monolithic biological psychiatry castle. And the tools are to say to them, and this is what I'll say to Dr. Paris if he accepts my invitation to a debate, I will say to him, Dr. Paris, you're an editor. You're right at the core of the orthodox psychiatric profession. How come your journal does not have a scientific publishing policy? How come your journal advocates a model which I showed 12 years ago does not exist? I don't think he'll take up my invitation. I don't think he's brave enough.
Well, I guess maybe he just doesn't have an answer, right?
Well, then just stand up and say, sorry, we goofed. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. Nobody's perfect. The whole point of science is criticism. And just as people had to say, oh, after all, the world isn't flat after all, because when Columbus set sail, due west, he proved everybody else wrong. By the very simple expedient of sailing due west, he proved everybody else wrong. He proved that the world was round.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he thought it was. He thought it was round. That's why he sailed west. But people have got to be prepared to stand up and say, we've got it wrong. We need to start again. Well, I've done most of the work, and in fact, I've formulated a whole theory which is just sitting there, and all they've got to do is read it and then start to apply it, and they'll find that things change very, very quickly. That's all been done. I've done the work.
I was just going to ask you about that because I think, you know, and I've read your two books, and again, you know, I'm not a professional, but I mean, wow, it's like I'm also sort of a student of philosophy, if you will, so like it made a lot of sense to me. And so can you just describe a little bit about, you know, what your model is?
There's several parts to my work. One of them is attacking and demolishing the biological model. And I think I've now completed it. There are now no avenues left to them. There was one avenue left at the beginning of the year, and that was the what's called functionalist theory of mind from Daniel Dennett at Tufts University in Boston. And I found a fault in that. And so that's the end of that. Now, Professor Dennett is not responding very well to this. You know, he's 69 years of age, and he's at the top of the profession, and some jerk from Darwin in Australia, you know, where, comes along and says, sorry, Dr. Dennett, you actually have made a serious mistake. He has responded very, very badly to that. And when I said I'd like to come and debate it, present my material to you, he emailed back and said, you can do what you like, but I won't be there. Well, that's not very gracious. But anyway, so I've done all that. The second part is to derive the principles of a formal theory of mind for psychiatry, and I've done that. So this sets out what I call, for want of a better term, the biocognitive theory of mind. In fact, that term's actually quite old. It's been around for a little while. But I've shifted it a little bit, its emphasis to psychiatry. And so this gives a biological resolution, a molecular resolution of the mind-body problem for psychiatry. In fact, it'll work for everybody else if they want to apply it too. But the whole point is that it's for psychiatry. So for the first time in the history of psychiatry, there is now a theory of mental disorder which starts as a theory of mind, as a philosophy of mind, and goes forward to a theory of mental disorder. In the past, psychiatrists like Freud started with a theory of mental disorder and then worked backwards to try and fit a theory of mind to that. And that's where it all went wrong. So they've got the theory. It's all there. All they've got to do is read it. but I don't think the older generation will read it. I think it's just beyond them now. They're just too set in their ways. They've got too much emotional investment in the biological model.
And so with a theory of mind, I mean, can you sort of briefly give us a sort of idea that lay people can understand what that actually means?
A theory of mind is something that is a theory that accounts for your everyday experience of being a thinking, feeling, experiencing, emotional creature. If I'm just looking out the window now and I can see a lot of trees and I can see a grey sky, that's pleasant, and I can see the trees moving and I can feel the chair on my back and I can hear birds. So I've got all these experiences and I'm aware of a person over on the other side of the world talking to me, so I've got knowledge and I've got experience. And I've got all these mental precepts, and these come together to form a concept called my mind, and we need to account for that. Now, the biological theory says that mind just is a form of brain function, and that's the end of that. I don't believe it is. It's a much more complex matter than that. The mind is irreducibly psychological. It is separate from the brain and has to be dealt with in mental terms. So that's what I've done, is I've shown how these concepts fit together, how we generate language, for example, how we move, how we make decisions. I can't explain the experience of seeing a colour, for example, or hearing something, but I can put that one aside, because what really counts in psychiatry is how we make decisions. And that one, of course, is in fact the easiest. So it says that we subconsciously make a decision which ends up with us getting depressed. Now, that's not the same as saying in that cynical way we choose to get depressed, because nobody's that silly. We don't choose to get anxious, but it is a decision of the same order as recognizing that that color in front of me is pink. Just the same as I'm talking to you now, and I couldn't tell you while I'm talking what the third next word will be, but it will come out correct and in context, and you will understand it. And these are all unconscious processes. So too, it's an unconscious process that we switch on our anxiety when, for example, we see a frog or a toad or a snake, or when we have to speak it in public. So these are unconscious processes, and this process of psychotherapy then is to bring those processes to conscious awareness and to deal with them, not to flood them with drugs. That's where it all goes wrong. So I've given them that theory. It's all there. All they've got to do is read it.
And so, yeah, all they got to do is read it, if only, right?
Yeah.
Well, and so what was I going to ask you next? So what do you think the future of psychiatry is?
My feeling of psychiatry is very, very gloomy, as it is at the moment. If we continue on the course we're on, the profession of psychiatry will eventually cease to exist. And it'll cease to exist for several reasons. The first one is that not enough people will come into psychiatry and train. The number of medical students entering psychiatry as a proportion is dropping. Not only is the number dropping, but the age of the trainees is rising, and there's a whole lot of other factors. A lot of them are part-time, this is second careers, they're not interested in ordinary psychiatric practice, they want to go into academia, they want to go into highly specialized areas, they want to work part-time in the city, they don't want to go out into the country, etc., etc. So psychiatry is actually going to run out of psychiatrists. Probably in about 120 years, I think, on the statistics. The second thing is that the governments will just strangle it by saying we're not going to spend any more money. And they're diverting the money from ordinary psychiatric practice out to different fields. So the money which used to come to psychiatry now goes out to the Youth Suicide Initiative and the unemployed youth program and things like that. And that's handed to people who, generally speaking, are not very well qualified in this area. And then they start offering counselling. And I know this goes on here because the people with a three-month diploma or certificate in community services are offering counselling to people with serious mental disorders. And what that's supposed to be, God only knows, but they're being paid by the government. So that's where the money's going. And the third one, I think, is that the general public will wake up to the fact that there isn't a drug for all seasons, and they'll just get sick of it. They'll get sick of the side effects. And the last part of that, of course, is I think that the drug companies will be increasingly at risk of being sued, just like BP is going to be sued possibly into bankruptcy by its accident in the Gulf of Mexico, so the drug companies will be sued by people for complications of their drugs.
And in the meantime, what happens to people who need treatment? Like, you know, not just pills, but help?
Nothing. Nothing much. They just wander around in circles and queue up here and then get disillusioned with that and hear of another magic centre, and they rush off over to that and queue up there, and then years later they find out that's no good. Just as you one day said to the bloke, to that chap, no, I don't want your drug, I'll go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. That will happen, except there'll be this huge group of people going round and round. And this is already happening. When they closed the mental hospitals over in the 60s and 70s and said we're going to provide community treatment, which of course they didn't, all they did was they pushed a whole lot of chronically mentally ill people out onto the streets and then into the prisons. I mean, they're still there. They haven't gone anywhere. They've just gone to the other side of the road.
And that's a lot more expensive.
Sorry?
It's a lot more expensive.
I don't believe that mentally ill people should be in prison just because their voice has told them to smash a window or something like that. I don't think they should be. I think they should be given effective treatment. Now, part of that treatment in the case of chronic psychosis is going to be medication, but it's got to be medication judiciously handled by people who are familiar with the patients. None of this sorts of thing where you have people with chronic mental illnesses who've, in the course of 2 or 3 years, they might see 20 or 30 different mental health staff, and only one of them or two of those will be a psychiatrist who might see them for 20 minutes a year. To me, that's just reprehensible.
Well, you know, one of the things I know about what's going on, like in my own community here right now, the psychiatrists are now having 10, 15-minute, a maximum kind of 20-minute appointments, and they're just kind of, they're medication appointments. There's no therapy, not from psychiatry, anyway.
What can you do? What can you do in those 20 minutes? 20 minutes once a month. I do see some people for 20 minutes once a month, but these are people I know have known extremely well for years, and their conditions are essentially stable, and they're functioning. And all we're doing is just touching base and making sure that things are going okay and heading off trouble. Now that costs about $37. And $37 once a month to keep somebody with a chronic mental disorder functioning in the community, I think that's pretty cheap. And so do they. And that is now possible.
What I do know of is the fact that I'm not just talking about people who are stabilized or whatever. Somebody goes to the local emergency with a crisis and then they go through that system, they'll end up getting a 20-minute appointment with a psychiatrist because it's really about, well, it's an overburdened system. It's not all, you know, whatever. And they'll just get a prescription. And then they'll get sent out, like you were referring to earlier, they'll get sent out into community stuff like agencies where they might have a counselor. They could literally have a social worker in training as a therapist.
This is absolutely correct. And so a month later, they're in another crisis. So what do? They go back to the emergency center where they sit for 6 or 8 hours, and it costs the government $1,500 per consultation in an emergency center. When I was in Detroit receiving hospital in October last year, now that's pretty big in Detroit, as you know, they've got a lot of social problems, and their psychiatric center was locked. The psychiatric area was locked, and a patient went in there, his clothes were taken off him, and he was given a little smock, and he was sat on a bed in a public area, and he would sit there 4, 5, 6 hours, 8, 12 hours, while somebody wandered around and took a bit of information and then went away and then came back a while later. And I said to the director, this must be costing you an awful lot of money. I said, it must be costing, about $1,000 per patient to come through here. He said, no, it's actually $1,132. I said, well, I reckon I could do this for about $147 per patient, because that's what it cost me in Australia.
Uh-huh.
And he said, no, you can't. And I said, well, why not? He said, corruption and inefficiency. You cannot do it. You can't change the system. And I felt very despairing after I left that. This is the US. We're not talking about, you know, the back box of Australia where we're dealing with Aboriginal people out in the desert. We're not talking about somewhere up in the northwest provinces of Canada or Namibia or somewhere like that. We're talking about a major centre in a major country, the world's most the wealthiest country.
Yeah, I know, and it's very disheartening. And, you know, I just have to ask you this question because it's something that, well, it's a real, you know, burr in my bonnet or however they put it. But what do you think generally of the DSM, like let alone like the current one, but what's happening with the DSM-5 that's up and coming?
Well, I've published criticisms of the whole DSM project, the DSM-3 and 4, and essentially it is based on a perversion of a scientific technique called cluster analysis. And the cluster analysis, you're supposed to sort a population into groups so that every person in that group is more like another person in that group than he is like any other person in the population. So in order to do that, you have to have certain techniques. And DSM-4 and 3 have not followed that process. All they've done is rewrite the diagnostic criteria a little bit so that they look a bit different, whereas in fact they're not. And the idea that they can separate personality disorder into clusters is totally false. They cannot. The idea that there are categories of personality disorder is false. There are only dimensions of personality disorder, and they are possibly going to have to accept that. Now, when you come to the idea that you can just keep multiplying these categories of mental disorder without limit, it's just becoming absurd. We'll end up with one psychiatric diagnosis for every person on Earth.
Well, yeah, nobody's healthy anymore, for sure.
Well, that's because the criteria for diagnosis are so sloppily designed, so badly worded, that you could diagnose a ham sandwich with mental disorder these mm-hmm. days. Now, what's happening is that they have decided they need to take this further, so they published on the DSM-5 website, they published something which was to be considered for inclusion in DSM-5, and this was called the psychotic risk syndrome. And it was put in there at the behest of a group of researchers, and one of those is Australian, down in Melbourne. And they want to be able to treat people who don't actually have a psychotic disorder, but who they think might develop one. And treat, of course, means put them on large doses of very powerful drugs in the long term. And so they designed these criteria, which were just appalling. They were absolutely appalling. They were absolutely self-contradictory. But because they were so rubbery, you could more or less walk around and diagnose anybody you liked with this disorder. But it also meant that if there was somebody you didn't like, you could say he didn't have the disorder and he had to go somewhere else. And that would be your experience where they sent you off to see somebody else, just keep pushing you around from one door to another.
Oh, yeah, so when I started out, by the way, the psychiatrist says to me, you have borderline personality disorder, get out of here.
Exactly. Precisely.
You know, and that was like back in the mid-70s when there were no books on it. There was no internet. I didn't know what he meant. I didn't know what he just said. All I really knew was I had just been sort of re-traumatized and re-rejected and invalidated all over again, like home. That's all I really knew.
That's precisely the case.
That's how it started out, and that's kind of how it goes for years unless you find, well, I hate to say this, but, you know, I think people need to now look away from psychiatry and you know, get a good psychologist.
Well, that comment you've just made, I think, is terribly important in two respects. Firstly, it bears out what I said a minute ago, that psychiatry will die out because the general public will get sick of it. Mm-hmm. They will realize that this is all pie in the sky. All of this publicity, and it is pure publicity. The stuff on the news services about breakthroughs in neuroimaging and that sort of stuff, that's just pure publicity. We won't go into that. That's a separate area. That's got no scientific basis. So people will eventually wake up to it and they'll get sick of it and they'll go elsewhere. Now, the problem is they will go to psychology, but guess what? psychologists don't have a rational theory of mental disorder either. At the moment, they've given up on behaviorism, and they've picked up on what they call cognitive behavior therapy, which is just a crude little technology. It's not a theory. It's a little technology that works in some cases. But that doesn't work for the major mental disorders. You will not get away from using medication in severe anxiety, severe depression, and in the major psychotic disorders. It's not going to happen because these people, they're just too frightened. You can't bring them back to ground level just by talking to them. So eventually psychology will find out through the people get sick of them because they don't have a formal model.
Sorry, I was just going to say, I think too, though, that people have to realize, I mean, and the people that are able, because I realize some diagnoses, people, you know, have less awareness and less ability to kind of advocate for themselves. But people who can advocate for themselves, I think, have to realize that, you know, you really have to take some of this into your own hands now and kind of, you know, really be discerning about where you're seeking help, don't you think?
Yes, I do. And I think that brings up another important point, which is very, very fundamental to the whole ethos of a biological psychiatry, which is to say that when a person comes in, walks into an office and sits down and says, I get anxious or I'm depressed or I hear voices, and the person sitting on the specialist sitting on the other side of the desk says to him, you have a chemical disturbance of the brain and only I know what it is and only I can treat it. That is the most profoundly disempowering, dehumanizing thing you could say to a person. It's similar to what must have gone on in the medieval era when a person was picked up and taken before a tribunal, an inquisition, and they said, you are possessed. I mean, how do you feel when you're told your brain is out of control, lady, or your head is no longer yours, young man? You're screwy, and you can't tell it, but we can tell it. And that was the whole thing about this psychotic risk syndrome. It goes up to people who maybe they're a little bit quirky, and it says to them, you don't know it, but we know you are harboring a mental illness, and we have to treat you. And how terrifying, how disempowering, how dehumanizing can it be? Now, this, in order to sell this thing called the psychotic risk syndrome, that's the name of that's actually been changed recently. But in order to sell that, what they have to do is they have to go around and say, no, we're not out there dehumanizing and disempowering patients. We are caring for them because we are nice people and we don't do bad things. We just do nice things. And so you don't have to fear us because we're nice doctors and we're going to look after you. Trust us, we're doctors.
Yeah, well, and, you know, I think that, of course, you know, many people have this kind of inherent idea about, you know, it's changing, but doctors are sort of demigods. And I think what you described, you know, as being dehumanizing and unempowering, absolutely, I agree, but I think it's also an abuse of power.
Absolutely. Anything that dehumanizes and disempowers somebody is an abuse of power. It is definitely the case that there's a place for saying to somebody, look, your life is out of control and we need to bring it back under control quickly. And I believe you need to take these tablets for a short while until things are better. And, you know, I'm going to use my influence to try and sway you because I know you don't want those drugs, but I also know damn well that if you don't take them, you're going to end up in a lot more trouble, Junior. Now, of course, I don't always talk like that to people. That's the message you're giving them. You know, I'm going to, every now and then you really got to stand up and say to somebody, look, you've got to trust me. I've seen this too long. I was a psychiatrist long before you were born, and I've seen too many kids go down this path and end up in serious trouble, and I don't want you to end up in that trouble. So please please follow this program, even if you don't like it. And a lot of people don't want drugs. And so if you talk to them fairly and squarely and on a basis of equality, most people will say, well, we'll give it a try. And then, you know, once they start to get better, they're a lot happier. And then the real work can start. But in fact, you have to heavy them a little bit to bring them back into the corral, as it were.
And so what you're talking about now is the case where some drugs are very helpful as opposed to a bunch of drugs that are useless that people are being forced, you know, being pushed into taking that aren't helping them.
Well, there's a difference between saying, I suggest you try this medication for 4 weeks to see what effect it does. And these are here's a piece of paper with all the side effects on it. And this is exactly how you will take the drug. Versus, the first time you're seen, you walk out with four hugely powerful psychotropic drugs in large doses. And every time you go back and you say, look, I don't feel too good, they just say, well, stop that one, or get out all that dose there, and we'll add another drug to it. Just try a new one. I mean, that's just scraping the bottom of the barrel. That's just blind poking.
Well, and it's funny because, you know, I think in my own experience I did years ago when I was younger, like about 17 even, I had ended up seeing a psychiatrist, or was kind of pushed over to one, and he wanted me to take some kind of, I forget if it was Halidol or something, and it was supposed to be for my anger, you know. And I just thought, well, I didn't know much about my anger, except for I knew that no pill was going to control it for sure. And I mean, I wouldn't even take that. I guess I was lucky that I was so distrustful back then.
Well, I think, no wonder you got a bad reputation. But I think haloperidol was a very damaging drug. I never used it. I disliked that drug enormously, and I never used it. And it went through a period where the manufacturers, that's Janssen, had the market cornered with this stuff. And people were just given haloperidol for everything. I mean, if you were upset because you missed your bus, you got Haldol. And if you were upset because you missed two buses, then you got Haldol Depot, which is intramuscular injection, and it lasted a month.
Well, in my case, the nurse pushed me up against the wall, and I was going to get a pill for that.
That's right.
You know,
that's exactly right. But did anybody ask you why you were angry?
Oh, no, because nobody believed a word I said, you know, because they'd already written up chapter and verse their story, and, of course, witnessed and, you know, super signed and signed off on, and anything I had to say was totally unimportant.
No, see, this is completely wrong. The whole process starts with the person sitting down and saying, through that person's eyes, through the patient's eyes. You have to get in, as it were, get inside and be with and stay with that person in his world through the worst. And at the same time, you've then got to be able to say, I think this is where it's going wrong. This is how we get out. So the psychiatrist has to have one hand on, very firm grip on reality, and the other hand is inside holding the patient's hand and saying, this is the way out of this. Right? So that is not consistent with the idea of just pumping people full of drugs, because that denies their reality. That says to them, you're not angry. You don't have any reason to be angry. You've got a chemical disturbance of the brain, and you've got to do as I say because you're sick and we know best and mummy knows best. And I don't believe that that has got any rational basis in science. There's no rational basis for that in science whatsoever.
Well, you know, and this is another example, because I may as well just use myself as an example here. There was another time, and it was the same psychiatrist who wanted to force the medication on me in a different situation. I don't know, I guess I was arguing with him on the phone, to tell you the truth, and, you know, I was like 15 years old. But the thing is, so he sent the police over to my house. So next thing I know, there's these two great big policemen in my house, and I was living out on my own already, and I'm like, what, I didn't do anything. And they're like, oh, no, we're not here to arrest you. Your doctor wants you to go into the hospital, blah, 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 long story. But long story short, I didn't want to go. I wasn't suicidal or anything. I was just angry. But they saw a broken mirror sitting on a couch. Well, I was I was a kid. I was 17. I wasn't coping well, and I didn't have a job, and I was living on welfare. And that was my mirror. That's all I had. But so they looked at that and figured, well, I was about to kill myself somehow. Like it's just interesting how all this, and I'm just, you know, this is just an example from my life, but I wonder how many people have examples of where the system jumps to these conclusions that are just, you know, I don't know how they get from point A to point B, and, you know, and what's happening to people. I mean, somehow I got through all this, but a lot of people are dying, right, because they're not getting through it.
Because they're not getting through it. And the rationale by the psychiatrist then was, he said, this girl sounds like she's getting out of control and it could be dangerous. I have to act, because if I don't, I'll be in serious trouble, even if it's only my conscience that gives me trouble. But I have to act, and the only way available is that I send two policemen around, and, of course, things get worse. Things invariably get worse.
I just went with them. I wasn't going to fight them, but, you know, and I spent one night in hospital, and I got assessed the next morning, and I went home.
Well,
I wasn't
of course,
angry
the answer
anymore
is,
by the next morning, right?
Well, you know, most anger does wash over, but the answer to anybody is play the game. You know, just go in and say, no, doctor, I have no idea why I'm in here. You need to ask the police. And, no, I'm fine. No, I'm happy to wait, and then I'll go home. When you're finished, I'll go home. Do you mind if I have a cup of tea, please? And
basically, I did play the game because I didn't want to be there, right? So exactly.
So just play the game and you'll get out, and then, but you've still got to deal with the problem. So the thing is, a person who is angry has to sit down and he has to say, I'm angry for this reason. Now that's a bit of a problem, because by the time he gets to see the psychiatrist, he is usually ropeable. He is so angry that he starts banging the table. And psychiatrists are just human and they get a bit frightened, especially if they work in hospitals, and so they just call security. And then it goes from... It just goes completely out of control. Whereas in my little private practice, I don't have security. And so I just let them bang the table for a while, and then I say to them, well, have you had enough? Can we get on with it? And they usually laugh and say, yeah, let's get on with it.
Well, yeah, because I think like, you know, that if there's that expression happening that's a little out of control or not, you know, socially acceptable or whatever, it's the reaction to it that makes all the difference, isn't it?
It is, because I am giving my patients the covert and sometimes even the overt message, you are a rational adult and I expect you to keep control. Right? So I'm giving them that message. They're getting that all the time, because there is no security and everything's quiet and polite. And I introduce myself politely and I say to them, have a chair, and I keep it all polite and formal, and it's really quite formal to start off with. And I insist that they call me doctor. I don't use first names at work. And I call them Mr. Smith or Mrs. Jones, and it's all polite. And they feel secure with this, and they get their control back, and their fear dies down. And we just go through this process, and at the end of it, I say to them, is there anything else? And they usually say, no, I think we've covered most of it. And so they walk out, even if we're having an answer. They walk out and think, well, you know, that wasn't too bad, and we're getting a good start, and I'm going back, and we'll continue. So it's how you handle it. And if you threaten patients, they will respond as threatened individuals. It's very simple.
Well, right. And, you know, I'm just realizing that we're, you know, starting to wind down time here. And I wonder, you know, sometime if we might be able to talk even more, because I'm sure there's more still left over. But I'm wondering... What would you say now to listeners, you know, who maybe have been diagnosed with a mental illness or a loved one, and, like, they're hearing this and, like, maybe they'll do some Googling and hopefully they'll read your books. What are they supposed to think now? Because this has got to be at least confusing, right?
Well, I suppose it's better to be confused than to be led astray by ideology.
Mm-hmm.
That's my first response. If... A person, when people come in and say, oh, I'm bipolar and I've got a chemical imbalance of the brain, I say to them, what is the theory that proves that? And they just look at me blankly. And so a person who is told by a psychiatrist, well, you know, you're ADHD and you've got a chemical imbalance of the brain, or you're bipolar, or you're borderline personality and you've got a... And I'm just reading Dr. Paris's work here, the biological... factors in borderline personality consist of this and this and this, and I'd say to him, what is the theory you're using, doctor? What is the name of the theory that you are using to make that decision? Give me three references to that theory so that I can check their validity. You will not get an answer. You will not get an answer. And if you keep this up, you'll probably get a certificate to the nearest mental hospital, but you won't get an answer.
Well, I just wonder, you know, because I do work with a lot of people, and I, you know, have the experience of borderline personality disorder, whatever that means in my life in the past, and of course my parents struggled. What are those people supposed to do right now with the fact that, you know, this diagnosis is, you know, questionable in so many different ways, but that also that clearly you're stating it's not the brain disorder thing that so many others are saying it is. Now, what are they supposed to do? Right now,
well, I think Yeah, I know. This raises an ethical question. Are you within your rights to tell people that the ship they're on is sinking, or should you leave them to enjoy the trip that they've paid for? I mean, these are ethical questions, and my view is that it is not appropriate, in fact it is unethical, to claim that psychiatry has a model of mental disorder when in fact psychiatry doesn't. In my view, it is unethical of Dr. Joel Paris to say that the biopsychosocial model of mental disorder explains borderline personality disorder. It does not. That is the end of that. And so I suppose I'm in the difficult position of going around saying, alarm, alarm, things are not as they should be, things are not as they seem to be. And this is why the profession is responding so badly. And that's why I am quite gratified by the fact that the local editor got the chop, because he's been pulling the wool over people's eyes for years. But see, he's only one. He's only the editor and the chairman of the editorial board, because he's got six mates on that board, all hand-chosen, who also agree with it. So much as I don't want to, when the job comes available, I'm going to have to apply for it. I know what they'll say, but I'm going to apply, because at least that way they have to read my application.
Right. But what is it like being you? What is it like being you in this fight to, you know, really from an ethical standpoint, criticize legitimately, question also putting forth your own theory, and a lot of what I found to be quite reasonable thoughts and knowledge in these two books of yours. What is it like to be you and to be just, I don't know, it must be lonely, like you described it as being lonely.
I suppose the simple truth is I'm used to this. I mean, I've been in Darwin now. Darwin is a very isolated city, and I've been here for best part of 20 years, and then prior to that I was in the Kimberley region of Western Australia. I'm just trying to find my atlas, and the town I was in was as far from the capital city as New York from. There's a little place on Hudson Bay, I think it's called Churchill or Port Churchill or something like that. That's how far I was from Perth. Now, Perth is not a big capital. Perth is smaller than Vancouver. So really, it's as if I was living up in the Northwest Territories and not in Canada, except
so
I was in the desert.
There's geographical isolation for sure.
Yes, there's intense geographical isolation, and add to that, there is this intense emotional and intellectual isolation, and I've just had to keep saying, well, you know, I've done the work, and I do have to keep going back and reading this stuff again to make sure of it. Every 2 years, I get out the paper on the biopsychosocial model, and that everybody says is the definitive paper, and I reread it, and it's just about worn out. I'll have to get a new copy soon, but I reread it just to be sure that I'm not making a mistake. No, I'm not making a mistake. So the answer to the question is, not lonely. I mean, I've got my family here, and we live in the bush, and it's very pleasant. And now I'm in touch with people around the world by the internet, and I can talk to people like you on Skype, which previously we couldn't. And so the sense of intellectual isolation is dying down, because I can now get my books published, and I can now get my papers published. And the books aren't selling very well, but, you know, that'll happen. I just keep saying to myself, they laughed at Darwin. I don't know. I just use that for example. Darwin was never accepted by the scientific establishment to the extent that Queen Victoria refused to give him a peerage. He was entitled to one in quality of his work, but she refused to give him one. I just say, well, that's all right. You know, they laughed at Darwin, so I suppose I'm following in his footsteps, so I'm not, my work's not in his class, of course, but, you know, there are some exalted figures in the past.
It might turn out to be in his class.
Well, that's for history to say, for posterity to say, but I think the important thing is that it is critically important for educated people to take an a critical view of the role of psychiatry in society and its justification and its techniques and technology. It is too important.
You know what? I hate to interrupt you right now, but we're actually going to get cut off in about 30 seconds.
That's fine.
To say that I think you're really courageous, and I admire your work, and I'm going to do my little part in my corner of cyberspace to get the word out, and I would love to talk to you again, and I thank you so much for this interview, and I just wish you the best because it's nice to see someone stand up with such courage, strength, and intelligent conviction.
Well, thank you very much for those words. That's very encouraging.
Okay, so I'm sorry that I have to cut it so short right now, but we will get cut off.
My pleasure. Maybe we'll be in touch further. But
okay,
I'll let you know what comes from my contact with Dr. Paris. I think we can thank
you. Excellent. I'd like to know. And you just keep on going there because I think what you're doing is so important.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
And my guest today has been Dr. Niall McLaren, who is the author of Humanizing Madness, Psychiatry and the Cognitive Neurosciences, as well as Humanizing Psychiatry, the Biocognitive Model. You've been listening to the Psyche Whisperer Radio Show with your host, yours truly, AJ Mahari. Be sure to visit our website at psychewhisperer.com. Follow us on Facebook and or subscribe to this radio show on iTunes. And please join me again next time for another episode of The Psyche Whisperer on Blog Talk Radio.